is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
Wade, it opens wide for Wade. What a dunk! Fournier blocked his dunk. Here's Wade to get screen. Euro step. Basket.
Welcome to the Heat Check. I'm Wes Goldberg. With me, as always, it's David Rommel. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty good, man. How's it going?
Good, good. Are you practicing guitar with Chris Bosch? Are you going to play drums for his little blues band?
I was actually the one holding the phone for him, so I've already achieved master level when it comes to my guitar skills, so I'm just kind of helping him out through the offseason.
Okay, are you his agent or a publicist now?
No, not necessarily. Just, I'd say a good family friend.
Just a good Samaritan.
Absolutely.
All right, so we got a lot to talk about today. Not anything too immediate, but we have the scouting combine starting, the NBA draft scouting combine starting this week. So we want to get into that, a little bit about some potential free agents, some potential draft targets. But let's start with some hot takes, David. LeBron dismissing David Blatt's inbounds play and saying, "Nah, I got this."
I think it's what you could expect out of a guy like LeBron. Not necessarily a condemnation of his personality or anything like that, but clearly he's the team's superstar leader. And despite his shooting woes from the perimeter, which I think, you know, supports Blatt's argument that maybe he wasn't the right person to take that shot. I guess the whole politicking nature of the NBA, you know, the ever fluctuating relationship between a coach and a player. You kind of have to just make sure that your superstar is happy at all times. And if that means taking a shot despite going, you know, what, 6 of 30 for the playoffs, then you just go ahead and give him the ball and, you know, get out of his way.
Well, that's kind of the point of the superstar, right? Is you just, when you have somebody like LeBron, you just say, "Hey, man, I know you're not doing really great, but you're LeBron James for a reason. Go out and do something for me." I mean, I think a lot of Heat fans would say this would never happen under Eric Spoelstra, but Eric Spoelstra kind of just built it into his coaching theory. He would ask Wade and LeBron and even Bosch, like, "What do you think we should do here in huddles?" And you could tell Blatt had a play drawn up that he thought was a good play, wanted LeBron to inbounds the pass. So you can just imagine what happened when he saw LeBron was not on the sideline. But he kind of just let it play its course, I guess. I don't know if he had much of a choice, but Spoelstra just kind of worked into it. Yeah, Spoelstra just kind of said, "Well, what do you think we should do here?" And doesn't seem like Blatt really did that. And I don't think it's right or wrong there. I just think that when Heat fans said this would have never happened under Spoelstra, it routinely happened under Spoelstra. Not like LeBron dissing him, but LeBron calling the play. That routinely happened.
And I think you have to kind of give credit to Spoelstra. That's one of the things I've seen tossed about the whole narrative and the whole, you know, drama surrounding the issue. But, you know, Spoelstra was already an established coach. He was already an assistant in the league for years under Riley. He had been there for the 2006 championship season. He coached Wade, who was at the peak of his powers in 2008, 2009, before, you know, LeBron came around. So he already knew about the whole necessary massaging of personalities, especially mm-hmm. one at the superstar level like Wade was. So when it comes to drawing the end, and I think there was some balance there in the first season where you always had to wonder who's going to get the shot at the last second, you know? And so that was a much more difficult challenge for him. And not until later on did we realize, well, you know what? The players themselves were comfortable with allowing maybe a guy like Chris Bosh or certainly a guy like Ray Allen to take that last shot. And in Cleveland's case, neither does Blatt have the experience at these, you know, different personalities, especially one as tempestuous as LeBron's. But, you know, there's clearly nobody else there who could take that last shot or is as established a superstar as LeBron is. And so you kind of, you have to defer to the great one at this point.
And that's the great thing about LeBron, right? Is that he's so unselfish, he's not going to just take the shot with three guys on him if he doesn't feel like that it's the best play, you know? But you kind of give LeBron the ball because he's, quote-unquote, so unselfish that he will make, or you would assume, he makes the best basketball play in that situation.
But given how little time there was,
in that particular, yeah, exactly. In that particular play, he didn't. But just in general, like, if you're David Blatt going forward and you have a few seconds on the shot clock, you say, all right, LeBron, I think this is where I just defer to you because you're going to make the right basketball play. And that's what Spoelstra would do on a routine basis. Even if he gave, even if he called LeBron's number to end the game on the final possession, it doesn't necessarily mean LeBron was taking the last shot.
Okay. I see what you're saying. But then to Blatt's credit, or, you know, I'm not sure if that's the right term for it, but I think given, you know, LeBron's superior passing skills, clearly the best passer on the team, maybe it was in the best interest of Cleveland for LeBron to be able to, you know, zip a pass, you know, over a defender who would be guarding the inbounds play, and then finding, I think the play had been originally drawn up for Dellavedova, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe that would have been the right play. I mean, it worked out the way it did, but that's the whole thing about the playoffs and narratives like this. It's like, you know, he hits the shot, and clearly Blatt's an idiot, and he has no control of the team, and you know, the whole hiring was a mistake, etc. But if he misses the shot, or let's say he gets swatted into the third row by Jimmy Butler, do we still have this argument the next day?
I think we have an argument kind of about why Blatt has lost the respect of LeBron James. And that probably takes over, as opposed to LeBron James was right and David Blatt was wrong. Where I think this should just be a celebration of LeBron, right? Like, this isn't the first time a player has just went out and called his own number. I think the interesting thing here is that the Cavs got that free timeout. Blatt brought the players together in a huddle, mapped out this play, and LeBron's just standing there the whole time, like kind of just hearing him out and deciding, and he's like, "F that," like, you know, "That was great, nice little picture you drew there, David, but that's enough." Like what is that? Like, I don't. That to me is the interesting part, and I don't know if it shows a lack of respect, but either way, like, I don't care what the play you have drawn up. If Dellavedova is taking the last shot and LeBron's not, and that's, you know, and you're the coach drawing up the play for Dellavedova, I don't know about that. Call me old school. I don't care how good of a shooter he is, but this guy barely made an NBA roster, and he's been really great for them in the playoffs, but if you have LeBron, you just give him the ball, right? Like, that's just kind of, you just do it.
It's a tough call. And you wonder, I mean, clearly there are egos in Europe as well. So it's not like David Blatt shouldn't have been completely inexperienced to dealing with professional players that want the ball at all time. I mean, regardless of whatever league you're playing in, you're going to have guys like LeBron, even if on a much smaller scale. So I'm a little surprised that he would have gone away from LeBron at that particular play.
That was kind of the knock against him, though, right? Kind of coming into the NBA is that he hadn't dealt with American superstars and that culture, like the way that basically the players run the league, whereas in Europe, it's more of a coaches' league like it is in college basketball. And that was really the knock against Blatt from what I was reading. You know, everybody loved how he was going to run the Princeton offense and everything. It was going to be the perfect mix of the Princeton flow offense and LeBron James, and it was going to be unstoppable and sensational, but people wondered how he would react to LeBron, and I think that has been more true than anything of anybody's excitement or concerns with Blatt going into this season.
It's funny because I wrote about it earlier, you know, earlier to start the year, everybody's talking about what a genius he was. There were quotes from the players, LeBron, Mike Miller, and others saying, "This is incredible, what an amazing offense, the kid, you know, like, Blatt's a genius." And then you have a sharp contrast to, you know, J.R. Smith being misquoted as saying that the play call at the end of the game was dumb. What a contrast. What a year, a difference a year makes.
Right? I was thinking about that yesterday.
It's unbelievable. From genius to dumb in less than 8 months. It's incredible.
And it's not really fair because he was credited as a genius before he did anything. I mean, he had success, no doubt, but before he did anything in the NBA, it was like, oh, this guy's a genius. People, I remember reading like head coaching rankings before the season. People had Blatt in the top 10 already as an NBA coach. And I was like, can't we just leave him off? Like, is a ranking? Is somebody gonna be that upset that you leave Blatt off? He's not done anything. So, I don't know. I think his expectations were far too high, and it's really not fair to him. But at the same time, he's made mistakes. He was trying to call a timeout at the end of that game when it was clear that they didn't have any more timeouts. And, you know, his clock management's been not good. His lineup, you know, management's been not very good. But he's still learning at the same time. He didn't have that opportunity that Spoelstra had to kind of, you know, learn some things, take some punches before the spotlight was on him. So this guy's not only coming from, you know, not only getting his first NBA coaching gig, you know, coaching LeBron and Kevin Love and Kyrie, but he's coming to America to coach for the first time, you know, let alone just getting these three superstars together. So I don't know. It's interesting, and I think it's a cool little narrative going through these playoffs to see how LeBron basically just takes over the whole organization.
Yeah, and from a Heat fan's perspective, it certainly supports everybody's hatred, whether it's justified or not. Everybody is using this as further evidence that LeBron is a bastard, that he sold out to the organization, meaning Miami, and that when it comes to Cleveland, he has full control, something he would never have had here in Miami.
Well, we hear about like player coaches all the time, right? And Bill Russell was, what, the last one to do it, to be a player coach, am I right?
I want to say he was, yeah.
Yeah, so, and I know Bill Simmons, you know, wherever he's at right now, was wondering why the player coach hasn't come back in such a long time. But really, you think about what's going on now. LeBron's not only the player coach, he's the player coach and GM.
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean, not technically, you know. Right, not technically. But he still has a huge role in making personnel decisions.
And that's kind of the interesting part is, as a player, you kind of do have the final say of what goes on the court. Like, LeBron, any player in the NBA can kind of do this. Or any lead dog on his team can kind of do this. Is get on the court and run whatever you want. And I think this happens more often than not. I just, like, especially with the point guards, where they might just, you know, ditch a play on the fly as soon as the first screen isn't set correctly or whatever. I just think there's, like, a really big deal being made out of this one just because of the quotes, not necessarily what happened on the court, right?
Right. And it's funny because, you know, we have to clarify that. It turns out that J.R. Smith was just saying that there was doubt, because that was what the original question was. You know, a reporter asked Smith, you know, was there any doubt about Blatt's last-second play call? And Smith replied, there was doubt, but I guess the reporter who originally misquoted him said that was dumb, or it was dumb, or something along those lines. And so that really...
Maybe J.R. Smith should stop mumbling. Maybe that's the problem. I blame J.R.
You hear the video later on, and it's pretty clear that he's saying there was doubt. He was responding to a question where the word doubt was used, but apparently the reporter, you know, was a little eager, tweeted out this really hot take saying, "Oh, J.R. Smith is calling out Black, calling him dumb in the media publicly after a win in the playoffs." I mean, that's the whole exciting part of this, is that, you know, it was a pretty back and forth game, dull for the first 47 minutes, and then all of a sudden it comes down to this last minute stretch where they're trading baskets, etc. And, you know, and all of a sudden, after a win, you have a player supposedly, allegedly, being quoted as saying that the head coach is dumb. It made for some very interesting hot take
material. That's hearing what you want to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we got to move on to something else. I'm done talking about LeBron.
Yes.
The NBA scouting combine starts this week. It starts tomorrow, technically. We're recording this on a Monday, so it starts tomorrow, but like that's all the boring stuff. The drills and stuff starts Thursday. You and I have talked on this podcast about what kind of players and positions the Heat might be looking for.
Yes.
But they're going to be putting their skills on display. What specific skills do you think the Heat need to look for, regardless of position?
I would say three-point shooting, I think, is the most obvious one. Somebody who can space the floor a little bit better, because it seems like Luol Deng is no longer happy in that capacity as a perimeter-based shooter, and they're looking for somebody who comes in who provides a little bit more adept shooting than either Tyler Johnson or James Ennis, although both those players were pretty solid in that regard. But I think they're looking for somebody who can space the floor a little bit better.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'm interested in that Kentucky guy, Devin Booker, I think.
Yeah, apparently, you know, in my capacity in covering the Thunder, that's a player that they're looking for as well, somebody who can really space the floor. From what I've read in scouting reports, he's the best pure shooter, even though his percentages weren't great in college, right?
I watched him at Kentucky, and I didn't know anything about this kid, right? You're watching Kentucky, you're watching Willie Cauley-Stein and, you know, all those guys that are over there, but – this guy just started, I don't know if he was having a particularly good game. I think he missed the shot the first time I watched him shoot, but his stroke was like, just like perfect, you know, and I didn't miss by much. And I was like, who's this guy? And I kind of looked him up and he was pretty highly recruited, and just go figure, all the Kentucky guys are. When I saw that he was a first round prospect, he's kind of middling. Like, I think Draft Express has him at 15 right now. So it would be a bit of a reach if Miami was at 10. But I think if you just wanted a shooter, that's the guy, right? Like, if all you're doing is looking for a shooter, he plays the position that the Heat would need. I know we're not talking about positions right now, but that swing, shooting guard, small forward, that's a position of need if the Heat need one right now.
And I just thought of this right now, so maybe you have more evidence that would shoot this down, but I thought of two words that would potentially destroy anybody liking the pick of Devin Booker, but that's Daquan Cook.
Mm.
That reminds me too much what you're saying about Booker. A guy who wasn't shooting at a high percentage but looks like a great shooter. Sure, Daquan Cook fit the bill as well. I mean, he looked like he had all the potential in the world. I mean, in combination with, now I'm drawing a blank here, but the guy who's in Portland right now, who played for the Heat at one point.
Darrell Wright,
yeah. You know, it showed that Pat Riley, for like the first time in his career as a GM, was willing to take a younger player. He took his first one-and-done player in Daquan Cook. And he had all this potential. It never really panned out, did it? So, well, I mean, he looked like a good shooter. He was athletic. I mean, he fit that same kind of mold as far as what we're talking about Booker being. So I wonder if that's enough to kind of scare Riley off.
Well, he's averaging 10 points a game, and his three-point shooting percentage is 41.1%. That's not bad.
No.
I mean, it's not great for college when the line's in, but 41% is not, you know, it's not like he's shooting 36%. And it's like, but he looks good shooting it, you know? Like 41% is respectable, right?
Yeah, I think it shows that there's some potential there, but I wonder how much Riley at this point is willing to bank on potential.
That's the problem. And that's, I think, the problem with Devin Booker is that you can't play him right away. And the other thing that I'm seeing as a knock against him is his wingspan. I mean, I don't know how much weight you put in this personally, but he's 6'6", and he's got a wingspan of like 6'7".
It's not great, right? I mean, I don't know what that means. If you're looking for somebody who can provide elite level defense,
right,
or even solid defense, I mean, that's just not it. So, I wonder how much of that. I mean, that's a statistic, kind of like every NFL quarterback has to be 6'5" or taller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you wonder if you know, if Kawhi Leonard is having some impact on that. But it's something I think NBA scouts have looked for a while. There's a prototype player, and that doesn't fit the bill there. So, I actually really. I mean, I texted you about this a while ago, but I always thought that Kelly Oubre, just in the limited footage I've seen of him, looks like a real solid prospect to me. And he seems to have that same kind of mentality where he's a pretty solid defender, and if not great at this point, he has the potential for growth. He looks like a real good shooter. He can create his own shot. He's got the length and the athleticism. From what I've read, the knocks on him are that he wasn't always a motivated player for whatever reason. But I saw that kid, and to me, I'm certainly no scout, so what the hell do I know? But I saw a guy who could probably mesh very well with this team. Have you seen anything about him that maybe might deter somebody from thinking Oubre is a good pick at 10?
Well, you're preaching to the choir, brother, because that's my guy right there, Kelly Oubre. I mean, if
really?
If the Heat have a top 3 pick, I'd reconsider, but. If he's there at 10 and the Heat take him, I'd do a little Bill Simmons fist pump.
Nice. Yeah, good. I'm glad to see that because I think you're certainly more qualified than I am in that regard.
Am I? I don't know about that, but no, I wrote a piece a little while ago, just comparing him and his measurables to Kawhi.
Yes.
And they're not exact, but they're pretty similar.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, and that's how much can you actually project? I mean, the biggest difference that I found was that Kawhi at San Diego State was the man, right? And Kelly was just another guy. Oubre was only just another guy in Kansas. But that's been the knock against Kansas. Like, they don't really use their talent. That's Bill Self's thing. It's like they just kind of, like, they have this system in place and nobody really gets the spotlight. And that was the whole Andrew Wiggins dilemma. But, you know, so their usage ratings, like, I think Kawhi used nearly twice as many possessions per game as Kelly Oubre. And they were still able to put up similar numbers to an extent, other than their points per game. But, like, percentages and things like that were pretty similar. I know Oubre is a significantly better three-point shooter. percentage-wise than Kawhi was, but defensively they are similar. They have a good body type, you know, talking about height and wingspan. He's got 6'7" with a wingspan of 7'2", and I think Kawhi is 6'7" with a wingspan of 7'3", and most of that is fingers probably. So
yeah, good point. Similar athleticism. Similar scouting reports from what I saw. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of comparisons there, and you know, I think you and I have not necessarily argued, but debated on whether or not Miami should stick to a wing type player or whether or not they should get somebody for the front court. You know, my point is that I think with Whiteside's contract looming over the team, that maybe it would be good to have somebody there that's a bigger type player who could, you know, fill in for Udonis and Anderson when they shortly retire. Somebody that can learn on a daily basis from Whiteside and still get a little experience maybe at the D-League. So there's always options at 10 if Miami sticks with the 10th pick. But if you're going to draft a wing player, and I'm glad you agree with me, I think Kelly Oubre is a very good, solid choice.
If it's between him and Stanley Johnson, I think I'd take Oubre. I like everything I read about that kid.
Yeah.
And I know Stanley Johnson's the hot name, I think, because Arizona went so deep and people got to see him a lot. But I think Oubre is the guy. That's my guy right there.
From what I've seen of Johnson, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but he seems like he's much more, I guess, ripped, you know, maybe a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. Yep. I think the thing I've seen about him is that there's a lot more chance to develop more muscle at the NBA level because he's already got a good frame, so he can put on more size and continue to be a much more athletic, I guess, more strong player. But, I mean, how much of that really is a factor there? I don't know.
For some reason, the whole Stanley Johnson just screams Thomas Robinson to me. And I know they're two different players, but Thomas Robinson was kind of like a tweener, right? And he put on so much muscle in the NBA that he ended up just being a power forward who couldn't really do any power forward things other than rebound. Right. And the only reason he can rebound so much is because he puts so much effort into it because he can't really do anything else.
Right. He's reckless and, and athletic, and he throws himself in there like a cannonball. And sure, after a while, you're going to grab a rebound or two. But
Stanley Johnson just screams Thomas Robinson. And I am probably the last guy on Thomas Robinson Island, by the way. I think it's been a poor fit everywhere he's been. He's just got a bad draw of cards. Starting in Sacramento and whatever, but
you wanted him in Miami, didn't you, when it was a possibility?
Hell yeah, I wanted him in Miami. I think he should be the next Haslam, but I'm all in Oubre, but
blow a 10th pick on him. That's
so I think when we keep falling into that trap of trying to find the next Kawhi Leonard, and it's like, well, who comes closest to being Kawhi Leonard? We might not have a Kawhi Leonard in this draft, you know? Like, there's a possibility that a future finals MVP at the small forward position is not in this draft. So, but to a larger extent, there's kind of that prototype for Kawhi where it's like, you know, Kawhi, Paul George, Jimmy Butler, all these guys are kind of the same player-ish, really good on defense, getting on the court early because they're really good defensively. They're all that small forward, 6'7"-ish, kind of lengthy, good frame guys, you know, smart guys who have room to develop on offense. And that, to me, Kelly Oubre is in that mold. So rather than looking and trying to compare, even though I'm guilty of comparing stats to another specific player, looking just for that mold, and if that's what's in vogue right now in the NBA and that's kind of what we're pushing players to be, I think Oubre is the closest thing that he can get to that in this draft.
And it's funny because you look around the league, and I think there was a great piece earlier this year by Ethan Skolnick where he wrote about the point guard position being the premier spot in the league now. You know, you have so many quality players at the point guard position. As good as Kawhi's been, it seems like most people, to me, would be thinking about upgrading the point guard position where they could get a quality defender / scorer at the point guard position.
You're not talking about the Heat specifically. You're just talking, like, in general in the NBA.
Correct.
Okay.
I mean, wouldn't you think that with the number of point guards that are going to be dominating on a day-in basis, then maybe it would be in your best interest to find somebody who could potentially be a defensive stopper? You look at a guy like Patrick Beverley, you know, maybe somebody like that, kind of slip through. Maybe the whole thing is you can find somebody like that in the later rounds. You don't have to blow a lottery pick on them. But it seems to me like it might be in the team's best interest for to find somebody along those lines.
Well, I've always gone against the grain against this whole point guard is the most important position, because you look at who's won championships these last few years, and it's never point guard-led teams, right? It's LeBron James. It's the Spurs with Tim Duncan. It's, you know, the Dallas Mavericks were not a point guard-led team. You know, the Lakers, the Celtics, you know, they had Rondo, but that wasn't, you know, he wouldn't lead that team to that first title that they had. So I don't believe, and I know, like, kind of, we're talking about the future, but that's just because there's a lot of really good point guards. I've always been on base with you, and I even talked about this when we talked about Norris Cole being on this team as the starter at the beginning of the year, is Norris Cole doesn't have to be great. He just needs to be good enough to defend other really good point guards. He just needs to be good at that one thing. That's all we need him to do. But he couldn't even do that this year, and he was so god-awful. We just needed him to be an average ball handler, and he was so bad at it that it just didn't work out. But, yeah, to me, you're going to – if the whole idea is to score points, I don't really care what position the points come from. But if you can defend another elite point guard and you can get Patrick Beverley like that at that value, but have James Harden on that team and have Dwight Howard and even a guy like Josh Smith, just guys that can create mismatches and do things with the ball, I think that's – I'm with you. I think that's the way to go. I don't know if you necessarily need to – look at the point guard position and say, we need a great point guard, especially if we're going to say, we want to do this whole share the ball, spread the floor thing, where maybe the point guard doesn't have the ball as much as they used to.
Interesting point.
Yeah. So, let's talk quickly. Well, I wonder if Pat Riley's back from Spain yet. He's probably taking as much time as he wants over there, right?
I haven't heard any updates from him. I mean, I've been so busy practicing guitar with Chris, I haven't really checked up on Pat.
You said you were practicing. You said you're holding the camera. Get your story straight, David.
I mean, it's not just when I say practicing, I mean more of an instructional kind of role.
Sure.
But either way, you know, it's all part of the fun and games. You know, you should have been there for the Kevin Hart concert. We had a great time.
You sent me some Snapchats from there. Nothing I can share publicly. So Pat Riley and the gang, we're in Europe, in Spain,
yep,
checking out Mario Hezonja.
Correct.
And Kristaps Porzingis. So his name's Kristaps, number one, and he's a 7 foot, 220-pound, 19-year-old from.
Yeah.
And he's a long range shooter. He's basically Nikola Mirotic, from what I'm gathering.
A little Nowitzki, maybe.
Yeah, right. That's what we all say. Oh, you're a 7 foot guy from Europe. You must be, and you can kind of shoot. You must be Dirk. So,
yeah
I think the ceiling is Hall of Famer Dirk Nowitzki, and his floor is like Irsan Ilyasova or something.
Oh yeah, I guess or Darko Milicic.
Oh jeez, yeah. And then this Mario Hezonja.
Forget that one.
Yeah, right. Mario Hezonja is a little bit of a slasher, a shooting guard type guy, who can do some things with the ball. So he's kind of the opposite of this Kristaps feller.
Yeah, 6'8", good wingspan.
Mm-hmm.
Similar, you know, in that kind of mold that we were just talking about. So the only thing is that, you know, he's a European player, and, you know, there's a bad history in Miami with European players. You know, I don't know how far back you want to go, but they took a chance on some players in the past. They brought over, I want to say, what was it? Sasha Danilovich. That was a long time ago.
That was what, 1990?
Yeah, that was 96, I think, in his second year.
Yeah, 96 or 97 or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, a great offensive player,
mm-hmm,
but he just never really adapted to the level of athleticism in the league, couldn't handle Riley's defense. This is at a time when, you know, they were still playing bruiser ball here in the Eastern Conference. You know, you still had Jordan and the Bulls, and you still had teams like the Knicks and the Heat and others that were, you know, had the only way they could possibly compete is by playing defense at a very aggressive and physical level. Nilovich didn't fit that mold. So who knows? And maybe in today's NBA, he could have been more of a Peja Stojakovic type player, somebody that was a really good shooter on a really good offensive-minded team, but that wasn't the case. So that soured him a lot. And then there was also, I think Ira Winderman pointed out that Riley has always felt a little burned by drafting Martin Morisep. And I always forget him because he never even really played for Miami. I think he wound up playing 27 minutes with the Heat. I'm looking at it right now. And he did 27 minutes. That was
Wasn't he traded after that or released or something?
He was traded to the Dallas Mavericks in the move to acquire Jamal Mashburn. So that's...
Mm.
I mean, I know Dallas was eager to get rid of Mashburn because of that whole really overly dramatic situation in the locker room with Jimmy Jackson and Jason Kidd and everything else. But still, I mean, they traded him away for a guy that never even wound up playing for them. So that's a whole story in and of itself. But still, there's always been an anti-European bias there. And, you know, they've asked Riley about it in recent years. And he was quoted in that piece by Winderman, you know, when he was talking about in 2010 – Miami had all this cap space and whether or not they were going to make a move. You know, he says he likes the homegrown product, meaning, I guess, American-born players.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, clearly that turned into Chris Bosh, LeBron James, and Dwayne Wade. So I would say Riley made the right move there. But maybe from my perspective, there might be a little bit of a softening on that stance because, you know, he took a chance on Goran Dragic. So here's a European player. Maybe he didn't necessarily, you know, flourish as soon as he came into the league. But he's since become a very good player, and Riley, I guess, sees that there's potential there. So maybe he's willing to soften his stance, like I said, just a little bit, and take a chance on a guy like Hezonja, who has a lot of upside. Now, that's not to say that there isn't some negativity to his game.
I think the thing with Dragic, right, is that was a proven commodity. He knew what he was getting. He wouldn't have drafted Dragic, but seeing how he did and knowing what he could get for those draft picks that he sent to Phoenix, I think he was okay with it. You know, and I think the problem with the European players is you have such a small sample size that you're looking at, right? You're seeing video clips and just straight up things, highlight packages on YouTube and things like that where, you know, here you could just turn on any game on Saturday and see, you know, the four players that are going to go in the first round for Kentucky. You just watch them play you can watch every single game. So I think there's that, and you know how Riley, he in general, he's risk-averse. He just doesn't like drafting players, period. He'd rather just have veteran guys that are 4 or 5 years in the league already. But, and so when you kind of combine that with just the whole European package, you just have more doubt lumped together. And then I think you hit on it, though, with the way the league is going now with more of a European flavor, I think drafting a guy from that system is a little bit easier because they come into an American system, which is basing a lot of what they do on these European styles of play, this Mike D'Antoni stuff, and maybe it doesn't take as much for them to get used to this system and kind of figure out where they fit in it. I don't know, but I think right now is I don't know if I'm willing to go to the point where he's softened on it or that he's even considering drafting a guy from Europe, but when you have probably the 10th pick, possibly a top 3 pick, you got to do your due diligence. And that, and if there's two guys in Europe who are, you know, slated to be top 10 picks, you got to at least go check them out.
Yeah, I agree there. And I do like what I saw. I mean, given, you know, what you just stated about being the, you know, highlight reels, etc., and limited footage, I'll have to admit, I did like what I saw from Hezonja more than what I saw of Kristaps Porzingis. I like his athleticism. He does seem like he's a flyer. He has got some nice hops to him. He doesn't strike me as kind of the European players that we've seen in the past that look a little stiff, maybe not as explosive. He's young. He's 20, but at the same time, he's been playing professionally for a number of years. He represented Croatia in the FIBA World Cup, so there's been some good experience there on his part. I could see him thriving here, but then the knocks are also that he shoots a little bit too much. It's not that he's a bad shooter, he just shoots a lot. 75% of all of his shot attempts were jumpers. So considering his athleticism, you would think maybe he's a little averse to driving to the cup. I don't know. These are the kinds of concerns that I guess a guy like Riley would certainly have. But and there's also been some talk that maybe he's a little aggressive and not easily coached. I wonder if there's, you know, between having a kind of disparity as far as language is concerned, coming from Europe, et cetera, maybe he wouldn't necessarily fit into a culture as ingrained as Miami's. But, you know, it's interesting. You said it best. I think Riley had to do his due diligence. It's worth scouting a player like that. At the end of the day, if you asked me whether or not I thought Riley would draft somebody from Europe, I'd say no.
We're all in on Oubre. That's what the listeners should take away from this.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about free agency. Some rumor mill churning going on that Damari Carroll, who is set to be a free agent, or at least test free agency this summer, could be an option for the Heat to go after? You were talking a little bit about this before we started recording. Why don't you just take the reins here?
From what I read by Jason Leiser of the Palm Beach Post, he mentioned that this is all in context of whether or not Lou Aldang winds up opting out of his contract. Mm-hmm. It seems like the scuttlebutt more and more is that Deng is looking to squirrel away that last potential multi-year deal that might be worth less money on a yearly basis, but more money overall before he starts getting minimum contracts because of the overall wear and tear, etc. He had a great season, played in 70 games, a little inconsistent, obviously, you and I have talked about that, but regardless, it looks like more and more Deng might be leaning towards opting out.
If I were a betting man, I'd say he leaves. I don't think he's with the Heat next year. Like I said, I think they're going to – if he's going to opt out and he's going to try to find that long-term deal like you're saying right now just to get one more deal before he retires, and the Heat are going to be like, oh, good luck, you know, just call us before you sign anything. And then they'll say, this is what they're offering me, 4 years, $7 million a year. And the Heat will be like, you know what, we're not going to come up that high, and that'll be it.
You think $7 million? You think he's legitimately worth $7 million a year at this point?
Do I think? I wouldn't pay him that, but I think a team like maybe like the New Orleans Pelicans or – somebody looking for their Paul Pierce kind of guy, they're going to be willing to maybe shell out $5 to $7 million a year. I think if the Heat gave him $5 million a year, I'd be okay with it, but not for 4 years. And I think it's going to be the length of the contract that's going to get Miami.
Wow. Mm-hmm. It's funny because, you know, I mean, he could opt out and it could wind up, you know, like egg on his face. You know, he could wind up not getting that deal offered by anybody, although right. You assume that there's enough bad GMs out there. If anything, the Knicks will throw some money at him, right?
If anything, the Knicks and Lakers will be at his door.
For sure. I think $20 million 4 years. Yeah, what the hell do we care? We're not going to do anything in that time span anyway.
The Nets will find a way to rustle up some money. But Damari Carroll is an interesting prospect. I don't think that the Heat are going to be in his... I mean, what you were saying, Leiser thinks he's going to be around, what, $8 million a year?
That's the talk, is that, you know, he's not made a lot of money in his career, supposedly. And so despite the fact that he's had a very good season in Budenholzer's system in Atlanta, he might not command that. I guess people might think, well, it's a contract year. You're not sure exactly what you're going to get out of Damari Carroll. What if you take him out of the system that they're running in with the Hawks, and he doesn't, you know, he's not the player that he's been, you know, maybe he's been tossed around to a number of teams. His career hasn't been great, you know, up until this point. Yeah, sure, he was the only player not to make the All-Star team for Atlanta this year.
Yeah, I guess if you're really looking and you're in the negotiating table, there's a few things you can kind of throw his way. I don't know, maybe that's about right, but I got to think there's somebody willing to come up a little bit from that to like $10 million a year or something.
Yeah, from what I'm reading, he's making $2.5 million this year. He's not going to get a better opportunity to cash in. It could be from the Hawks, or it could be from somebody else. I don't know what their contractual situation is. I know that they're probably going to throw a whole hell of a lot of money at Millsap, who I think is a better piece at this point, even though he might be a little older. I think he's more intrinsic to what Atlanta does. Maybe I'm wrong in that assessment. Carroll has been arguably their best player in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
So you could make an argument either way as far as who you'd rather sign, either Millsap or Carroll. I'm not sure what Horford's situation or Teague's situation or Korver's is. So, I mean, we're talking about the big five there in Atlanta. You know, they've got a great system in place. Those guys have bought in. They've really done a great job. But then you have to consider whether or not, if you remove Carroll from that system, whether or not he's going to be as adept. Now, the thing is that what makes him as alluring to Miami is that, yeah, he's a decent shooter. He's certainly been very good from the perimeter in the postseason. He's also a little bit younger than Lou Aldang. I think he's a year younger and certainly has played a lot less than Lou Aldang over the course of his career. I think this is, you know, one of his few tastes of playoff-level activity this season. So, you know, he's a guy with less wear and tear. It could thrive here in Miami. He's a good, solid on-ball defender. He's a good team player, obviously, from what we've seen in Atlanta. So if you could get, and let's say Deng opts out, and all of a sudden you have this cap space available where maybe you could sign him. I'm not a cap expert, so I wouldn't know for certain. I don't know if there's a cap hold. If you have to renounce Deng's rights altogether, I think that's what you'd probably have to do. And then all of a sudden that would free up the room so that you could go after a guy like Damari Carroll. But if you could potentially get Carroll for 8 years, and maybe that's the deal, though. Then maybe you're talking about, instead of signing Deng for 4 years, $5 million per, you're talking about getting Carroll for 5 years at $7 million per. Mm-hmm. You wonder if Riley would be willing to make that kind of a commitment.
I think more tempting than Damari Carroll is going to be to find the next Damari Carroll. Some guy that's bounced around the league in a couple of places, hasn't really produced that much, gets a chance, and he's in the right system at the right place at the right time, and he's able, because Carroll's numbers weren't great. You know, he wasn't even a good three-point shooter until he just found a bunch of wide-open shots because he's got this team around him. And I think the Heat are in a situation when you have Bosch, Whiteside, Wade, and Dragic, where that small forward guy isn't going to command as much attention. And if he's willing to buy into standing in the corner and for three-point shots and then just defending at a high level, which I think, dang, his defense is going is declining, his abilities are declining every year just because of age, and as you were saying, he doesn't really want to be that corner three-point specialist guy.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I look at a guy like, I don't know if he's a free agent or not, but a guy like Chris Copeland on the Pacers, played with the Knicks for a little while, definitely has the offensive ability, is willing to do the hard work so they could stick to a roster. You know, guys like that who are in that small forward, but like a bigger small forward kind of guy who can defend, who have the frame. That, to me, is more tempting. I think Damari Carroll right now is overachieving for the talent that he has. And I think a lot of that is based on just the team that's around him. I don't want to take anything away from Damari Carroll, but there's no doubt that he's not the most talented player on that roster. And he should probably be the fifth highest paid guy on that starting lineup. But I think trying to find the next Damari Carroll so that you're not paying Damari Carroll $8 million a year, but you're paying the next one $2 to $3 million a year to get that kind of value back. Yep. I think that's kind of the goal.
Now, I'm looking at other potential players here at small forward, and I think Tobias Harris in Orlando is a solid pick, but I think he's probably going to be worth a little bit more just because of his age.
His age and what he showed the last couple of years. I know he had a rough year this year.
Yeah. Jeff Green in Memphis.
Somebody's going to pay him. Somebody always pays that guy too much.
Jay Crowder out of Boston?
That's my guy. But I think Boston locks him up. I think Crowder's the man.
He's also a restricted free agent, so you'd think they could probably match whatever offer Miami would be able to give him.
Yeah.
Other than that, Al-Farouq Aminu, I'm not sure if he's worth a long-term commitment.
No. I like him, though, but I don't know. I mean, you got to figure he's good defensively. He handles the ball pretty well pretty okay. He's okay. And if he's open, you got to imagine he'll hit some shots. If it's between Aminu and Deng, if you're giving me Aminu for the mid-level exception or Deng for $10 million a year, give me Aminu every day of the week.
Okay. Here's another potential option is Kyle Singler.
I like Singler. I don't know how much he could do on defense, but if you're looking just for a guy to come off the bench as your bottom four guys on the roster and you just need a three-point shooter every once in a while, why not?
Yeah, you know, Oklahoma City has some cap problems. They're going to be, over the cap in the luxury tax situation when they re-sign Enes Kanter, et cetera. So I'm not sure how much money they'll be able to give a guy like Singler, who's a restricted free agent. But I think they want him back. Still, it's an option. I guess he certainly provides some floor spacing, although he didn't necessarily do a great job of his shooting when he was in Oklahoma City. So I guess that's an interesting option. Other than that, there really isn't much to go around. And maybe that's where a guy like Deng and certainly Damari Carroll can parlay that into a pretty oversized contract, I'd say.
And the thing about Deng is we know he'll take his time in free agency, right? He has not been shy about doing that in the past. He's going to wait for the best offer.
I mean, he didn't necessarily do that with Miami, though, did he? I don't remember exactly. I think signing of the contract took a while, but the actual agreement was in place shortly after the whole LeBron sweepstakes.
Yeah, but for remember, like, there was a lot of courting. I know that the Bulls kind of wanted him back, I think, and the Hawks really wanted him, and he just wasn't going to sign anything, and all of a sudden this perfect situation fell in his lap when LeBron left Miami. And he might be just waiting. He hasn't been hesitant to wait, I guess.
See, I read the situation completely differently in that, you know, LeBron had the whole league by the balls until he, I mean, a few players, Marcin Gortat and Kyle Lowry, were the only players I remember that really made deals. I guess Pau Gasol also, you know, a couple of players of note made some deals before LeBron did, but for the most part, LeBron was holding everybody captive until he finally made his decision on July 8th. And then from that point forward, then everybody went ahead and the domino started falling, as they say. So I don't know. And, you know, as far as Atlanta's concerned, you know, there was that whole controversy with the scouting report and everything else. That's not worth bringing up, but still. So I'm not sure if that's an accurate knock on him. Maybe if that's something he's done in the past, I can understand that. But
no, that's a good point. So, I mean, I think the Heat should still, you know, you go after the small forward position in the draft, and you're using that exception on, I think you need to add a front court guy, maybe a backup point guard, depending on what happens with Mario Chalmers, depending on what happens with Josh McRoberts this offseason, maybe you're trying to replace that position. But I think this whole podcast can be nicely wrapped up by just saying, draft Kelly Oubre.
I think that's the way to do it. That's the headline.
That's the headline. Let's see, any other things we can get to really quick before we finish this thing off? Ray Allen taking picks in South Beach.
I mean, it's certainly worth discussing. I wrote about it earlier. You know, I think it's just something interesting to see a guy like Ray Allen, who, you know, as much of a villain as he was in Boston, has become so beloved in two seasons in Miami. I know Game 6 and that huge shot certainly has something to do with it, but you see his tireless work ethic, the way he compliments everybody in the team, and you know, those championship runs, and the way he was such a consummate professional throughout that time period, that I guess Miami fans certainly appreciate everything he's done. And so he sat out all of last year. He never publicly stated what his goals were. You know, a lot of people assumed that he would only come back and re-sign with a legitimate title contender. I know people were talking about him going to Washington, maybe San Antonio. Certainly there was a link of him following LeBron James and Mike Miller and James Jones in Cleveland, but none of that ever manifested. He sat out the whole year. But then what's got me somewhat excited, and maybe that's overstating it a little bit, is seeing recent pictures of him with Chris Bosh, with Alonzo Mourning, with Dwayne Wade, and not just at charity events, but going around town doing certain things. And then you see him posting nostalgic pictures of the American Airlines Arena, saying what good years he had. Maybe he's ready to call it quits, but I certainly wouldn't reject the possibility that he'll come back to Miami, and I think it's a great fit. I mean, he if he could come in here for, as you pointed out before the broadcast, if he could come in here for a good, you know, veteran minimum type deal, spell Dwayne Wade when he surely will miss a few games next year, he could be instantly bumped into the starting position at the kind of shape that he's in. It wouldn't be a problem for him. He's still a solid, you know, reasonably solid defender. He could mesh really well with Goran Dragic when Dragic drives to the hoop. You know, he'll compliment Chris Bosh. There's a familiarity with the coaching staff in place. He clearly loves Miami. He's constantly seen around town. I think he really enjoys his time here. So if he's going to come back into the league, I don't see why you wouldn't just go ahead and take a chance and not necessarily sign with a contender, although Miami might be, in the Eastern Conference, somebody that could advance all the way to the NBA Finals.
I mean, you look at the Cavs and their whole situation with Kevin Love, who knows? You look at the Wizards, they're decent. The Raptors are going to, it sounds like they're going to blow it up. I don't know. There's just like, there's not that many, you know, the Bulls, the Pacers, but does he want to go join the Bulls and everything that they're doing? He doesn't want to play for Thibs, and it looks like Thibs is gone anyway, but, you know, he doesn't want to go play for Indiana. So, I mean, I don't think he does. I think, I'm right there with you. I don't know if he's going to, if he necessarily, and there isn't like a bona fide contender like the Heat were. You know what I mean? It's like, if they just don't screw up, they're in the finals. Period. End of story. And I don't even know, like, you can't even say that about the Cleveland Cavaliers right now if they don't screw up. Because the Bulls are giving them a run for their money. I know they don't have Kevin Love, but you look at, like, next year, there's going to be a few good teams in the East. I don't know if the Cavs are just a, if they don't screw up, they're in the finals kind of team. And that's the kind of team I would think that everybody kind of thought Ray Allen would be looking to join this year. And I think maybe partly there wasn't that team this year to begin with, and that's why he didn't come back. But he might have played his cards perfectly, avoided the entire disaster year that happened in Miami in the post-LeBron world that we were living in, gave it some breathing room, and then just decides, all right, I'll jump in this year now, coming back. I'll just chill with my boys, hit some corner threes, do my thing, make $1.5 million this year. That might be all it is. Maybe he's not going to chase the ring. Maybe he's just going to chase a couple more paychecks. Why wouldn't you just hang out in South Beach, do your thing, make a little bit more than $1 million or like $1 million a year or whatever he's going to sign for? Yeah. Why not?
And if he could be, you know, on the flip side, can you imagine the whole veteran mentorship he'd be able to provide for a fellow UConn alum, Shabazz Napier? You know, he'd be able to guide Tyler Johnson. He'd be able to help Hassan Whiteside, maybe kind of mold him a little bit. I mean, he had an influence, even as, you know, over other veterans when he came to Miami. He had an influence on LeBron James. He had an influence on Chris Bosh, et cetera. You know, he worked really well with guys like Shane Battier, et cetera. I mean, I can't see any reason why Miami isn't an alluring option.
And he could turn it into, if you want to work for a front office, play for Miami for a couple of years, and you got a front office gig when you're waiting, right? Absolutely. So he could just turn that into a post-basketball playing, basketball coaching, front office stuff, whatever he wants to do. He could do that.
And in keeping with the theme of this podcast, how much can a guy like Kelly Oubre learn from Ray Allen at the three-point line?
So much. And he can learn how – and the thing with Ray Allen is you can learn how – he teaches you how to reform your stroke, reform your free throw shooting. I mean, LeBron James just modeled his three-point or his free throw shot after Ray Allen. I still think he's using it. And then, you know, you hear everything about treating your body right and doing all that. He got Dwayne Wade to try going paleo for a while, but Dwayne Wade missed bread too much and couldn't do it. But he can get, like, bona fide all-stars, guys who are established in this league, to become better. I think that's the kind of guy you want on your roster, even if he doesn't play a lick of time. You need him on your – it's worth one of your 15 spots.
Hell yeah.
Him over Henry Walker. Nothing against Henry Walker, just saying. Like, you know, you can kind of get a fringe guy like that who could kind of do some stuff every once in a while. Or you can get, like, somebody that can just change – like, headline a culture. I don't know. Anything else you want to hit before we sign off, David?
No, I think this has been a perfectly recapped Kelly Oubre based podcast.
I'm headlining this thing, the Kelly Oubre podcast. That should get plenty of clicks. All right. Well, thanks for listening. Check out the new website, heatcheckpodcast.blogspot.com. We don't have enough money to buy the domain, so that's why we're using the Blogspot URL. Go there. All the podcasts will be uploaded there. Just a little bit more information about David and myself. You can always follow us on SoundCloud. I recommend that you do. On the website, you can enter your email address and get free updates whenever we publish a podcast if you don't check your podcast app a lot. Speaking of your podcast app, subscribe on iTunes. Rate us and review us. We already have a few ratings and reviews on iTunes. Shout out to whoever you guys are that did that. Really, really cool. Super chill. Thank you. Am I missing anything? That's it.
I think that's it.
Subscribe, follow us on SoundCloud, heatcheckpodcast.blogspot.com. We'll check you out next week. Thanks, David.
You got it, Wes. Opportunity be knocking. You gotta let a motherfucker in. I kiss my mother on the cheek. Tell her that I love her. You ain't gotta worry about a thing. I got it covered. Why you think I'm out here acting crazy? Why you think I'm out here acting crazy?
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.